with medical experts from Mayo Clinic, Johns Hopkins, the Cleveland Clinic, and more. This is Med Clinic Radio.
Med Clinic Radio.
Exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you. Here is your host, Gina Tedesco.
This week, can short bursts of intense activity at home keep you in shape? We'll examine a recent study from an Australian researcher who found that as little as 4 minutes of high-intensity interval training per session can improve your health. And breast cancer patients might typically receive 5 to 6 weeks of radiation therapy, but on this week's Mayo Clinic Q&A, a radiation oncologist says the approach is changing. We'll discuss therapies that minimize patient side effects from radiation, including the increased use of proton therapy. Stay tuned. That's all straight ahead on this week's Med Clinic Radio.
Welcome back to Med Clinic Radio. Once again, here's Gina Tedesco.
How much exercise should each of us get to maintain or improve our health? Some guidelines suggest hours per week, but recent research into high-intensity interval training, or HIIT, brings a surprising and welcome finding, particularly for those of us who are limited in time, effort, or physical capability. Joining us now is Dr. Angelo Sabag, postdoctoral research fellow at Western Sydney University. He's an accredited exercise physiologist specializing in cardiometabolic health and physical performance. He was the corresponding author of the study. Doctor, first, describe high-intensity interval training, or HIIT.
Hi, Gina. Thank you for the question. I think it's really important to be able to describe accurately what high-intensity interval training is because there are differing views depending on the context for which it's used. In the general public, high-intensity interval training can refer to anything that is of high-intensity nature, including CrossFit-style training sessions. But in the scientific literature, we typically refer to high-intensity interval training as aerobic-based training, which is to say running, cycling, even swimming. And it's characterized by repeated high-intensity bouts interspersed or broken up with active or passive recovery periods. Now, the typical high-intensity interval training bout in the literature has involved 4 by 4 minutes of high-intensity exercise, which is about 80% of your maximal effort. And that was interspersed with or broken up with another 4 minutes of active recovery, which is at a lower intensity of maybe 30 to 40% of your maximal effort. And that was repeated for 4 times.
And in general terms, what are the typical goals of a HIIT regimen?
Well, I guess the primary goal of a high-intensity interval training regimen is to be able to improve either performance or health outcomes. Now, depending on the population which you're studying or the person's goals who is undertaking the training, that will change. So the typical person should, I guess, aim to improve fitness, so cardiorespiratory fitness, because we know from the available literature that cardiorespiratory fitness is associated with an array of metabolic and cardiovascular benefits.
And what about fat loss? Should that be a typical goal, or should that be something that's achieved elsewise?
Look, fat loss is a tricky one because exercise, although you're typically, I mean, if you undertake high volumes of exercise, so that means that, you know, throughout the week you accrue 300 minutes or so of exercise, you can expect to see a modest amount of weight loss. But personally, and as a clinician, I often advise against seeking weight loss or fat loss as a primary goal, just because there are a lot of factors that can contribute to whether or not you're achieving that goal. And if you don't achieve the desired weight loss or fat loss, it can really hamper your desire to continue an exercise program. So I like to focus on more performance-based goals. So that is to say, you know, today I'm going to go for a walk and I'm going to do 20 minutes and then you only get to 10 and you're exhausted. So then you say, well, okay, next week I want to try and get to 15. And so these performance goals have, auxiliary effects, which are weight loss and fat loss, but they should be promoted first because you have more control of those outcomes than you do of the auxiliary outcomes such as, you know, fat loss or weight loss.
So what are the World Health Organization physical activity guidelines? How many minutes or hours per week?
Well, the WHO guidelines I guess they typically expect adults to undertake at least 150 minutes of moderate intensity exercise per week. Now, they have an interesting, I guess, formula here when considering high intensity exercise or vigorous exercise. Now, they count 1 minute of vigorous exercise as 2 minutes of moderate intensity exercise. So they say that, you know, you can do 75 minutes of vigorous exercise, and that's equal to 150 minutes of moderate exercise. And those are the guidelines.
Now, your research looked at whether shorter versions of high-intensity interval training would bring benefits that rival the benefits from using the World Health Organization guidelines. Basically, what did you find?
What we found was, as I mentioned earlier, the typical high-intensity interval training bout involves 4 by 4 minutes of high-intensity exercise interspersed with passive or active recovery periods of a lower intensity. Now, we defined low-volume HIIT as having less than 15 minutes of high intensity exercise per session. So that means that the high intensity intervals, when accrued together or when added together, don't surpass 15 minutes. And we found that for individuals who are typically untrained, who have chronic conditions such as obesity and type 2 diabetes, that these interventions were as effective and sometimes superior to higher volume, moderate intensity, continuous training, which is what you typically see reflected in the physical activity guidelines.
We're visiting with Dr. Angelo Sabag, a postdoctoral research fellow at Western Sydney University, on recent research into the benefits of shortened versions of high intensity interval training, or HIIT. Dr. Sabag, along with the metabolic health benefits, you mentioned good levels of blood sugar, triglycerides, and such. What other benefits did your study find with shorter versions of HIIT? And when you say improving heart function, exactly what does that mean?
We actually categorize the improvements of low-volume HIIT into metabolic and cardiovascular improvements. Now, as you mentioned, the metabolic improvements include improvements in blood sugar control. And with regards to the cardiovascular improvements, when we talk about cardiac function, basically what we're saying is the heart can now do what it's intended to do more effectively, and that is to pump blood more effectively, because we saw that low-volume HIIT was an effective way to improve left ventricular function. Now, your heart works as a pump, and the left ventricle is basically the last chamber before the blood is pumped out into the rest of the body. So it's crucial that this chamber works as it should. And for people who have some kind of cardiovascular abnormality, this chamber starts to see deterioration and it limits its, I guess, performance. Now, it's not just, exclusive to low-volume HIIT, but what's interesting about low-volume HIIT is we can achieve significant improvements in these outcomes despite requiring less than 60% of the total training time.
Up next on MedClinic Radio, more about high-intensity interval training. Is it for you? Back in a moment.
Return to MedClinic Radio with your host, Gina Tedesco.
We're back now with Dr. Angelo Sabag, postdoctoral research fellow at Western Sydney University. He's an accredited exercise physiologist specializing in cardiometabolic health and physical performance. Our topic is a recent study on the benefits of high-intensity interval training performed over a limited period of time. Your research follows on your earlier research published in Diabetes Care. How much time spent per session and sessions per week did you discuss in that study?
Well, that was actually the capstone project of my PhD studies, and it involved 3 sessions per week for 12 weeks, for which the actual exercise study included as little as 4 minutes of high-intensity exercise.
4 minutes?
4 minutes, yes.
Wow.
And those 4 minutes were obviously broken up at the beginning of a study so that people could finally, once their fitness levels were, I guess, improved, they could achieve those 4 minutes in a continuous manner. But prior to that, like for the first 2 to 3 weeks, they would do 1 minute on, and then they would recover, then they would go another minute until the 4 minutes were finally accrued. And as I just said, you know, after the second or third week, they could pretty much easily do the 4 minutes in a row without too much trouble. And yeah, it was pretty incredible to see we had such improvements following such little training volume.
And what were those benefits that you reported?
Our primary outcome was looking at liver fat. So that's liver fat is a key characteristic of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And it's associated with insulin resistance and compounds the effects of type 2 diabetes. So that's why we looked at liver fat within the context of type 2 diabetes. We found that it significantly improved liver fat when compared to the placebo group who performed just stretching exercises. And also, it performed better than the moderate intensity continuous training group, which had incorporated 45 minutes of cycling at a moderate intensity. However, the difference between the two was not statistically significant.
So how did these benefits compare to the longer workouts like the WHO was looking at? And how vigorous were these longer workouts?
Look, it's always a challenge to define the intensity in the lay term, because within the literature, we use like percent of maximal heart rate, percent of peak oxygen consumption. However, we also use what's called rate of perceived exertion. Now, that can range from 0 to 10 on some scales and 6 to 20 on others. For our study, we typically found that people were undertaking the high intensity exercise at around 80% of their maximal effort. And that could range up to 90. But it was typically around that range. Now, the moderate intensity efforts were around 50 to 60% of maximal effort. So the difference would have been, you know, 20 to 30%.
What were the reactions from the patients when they got these results?
Well, it's actually interesting that you mentioned that, because in the high intensity group, I specifically remember various anecdotes of participants coming and saying, "I can't believe that the session's over. Surely this isn't gonna, this can't be it." And then lo and behold, after 12 weeks of exercise, they've had significant improvements in an array of, you know, cardiometabolic outcomes. Now, on the other side, we had participants who really struggled to comply with the 45 minutes of continuous cycling. A lot of patients found it boring, and this is reflected in the dropout rates between the groups. So within the high-intensity interval training group, there was no dropout. So that means that everybody who started the trial completed it. However, in the moderate-intensity continuous training group, we had two dropouts, and both of them reported that they couldn't continue the trial because of a reported lack of time, which in and of itself is a super interesting finding.
And what about the role of healthy eating? Were any of the patients you studied put on a strict diet, or was that just left the same?
So we undertook the study on free-living patients or participants, which means they were free to do what they typically do, but they were encouraged to maintain their current physical activity levels as well as their current eating behaviors. So we did take food frequency questionnaires to make sure that there wasn't too much of a change between the eating habits prior to beginning the intervention and at the conclusion of the intervention. But we didn't prescribe any kind of diet, no.
We've been talking with Dr. Angelo Sabag, postdoctoral research fellow at Western Sydney University, about the benefits of high-intensity interval trainings that last a shorter time than current guidelines recommend. Dr. Frankly, this all sounds almost too good to be true, as the patients kind of suggested. Is there something we're missing?
I love that you've brought this up, because the low volume variations of high intensity interval training are effective and actually very attractive for people who are currently inactive. They are detrained. They have conditions which may limit their ability to do exercise for longer amount of times. However, once you reach a certain level of fitness, you can no longer incur further benefits. It doesn't mean that you can't maintain the benefits that you've already achieved. But if you want to keep pushing yourself, you're going to have to undertake what's called progressive overload. And it sounds scarier than what it actually is. But basically what it just means is that you need to either increase the number of intervals you're doing or increase the intensity at which you're doing them. But in order to continue improving, something will eventually have to change.
And doesn't that cause a bit of discouragement among some people when they hit that plateau?
When people are training and they hit a plateau, it often takes a long time to overcome these plateaus, and you really have to mix it up. But at the same time, by setting yourself goals regularly, reassessing those goals and seeing whether you've achieved them, and seeing what you could do to further improve your current performance, that's an effective way to keep striving for that optimal figure of health that you've envisioned for so long.
You seem to be suggesting perhaps mixing HIIT with slow aerobic workouts on off days. Would there be a benefit to that approach?
Look, whatever you can do, and this is like, I guess the key takeaway is, look, whatever you can do to maintain physical activity levels or to increase physical activity levels within reason is beneficial. So if for you that means incorporating some kind of like weight training into your training regimen, that's great. If it means on your off days going for long, mindful walks, that's great also. At the end of the day, what we want to see is people exercising more frequently, because the benefits incurred as a result of low volume HIIT aren't necessarily exclusive to this kind of training. The benefit of this training is that you can achieve the results that you're desiring in such a small amount of time. So however you can accrue the appropriate amount of training minutes, I guess you should always strive to do it irrespective of the modality or the intervention that you wish to apply to your own personal training program.
And I suppose it goes without saying, but I'll say it anyway, the best advice is consult with your doctor on how much to exercise, would you say?
Yeah, definitely. Look, I know that in Australia, where I'm from, we have what are called accredited exercise physiologists who are specialized in delivering exercise therapy for individuals with chronic medical conditions. Similarly, the American College of Sports Medicine has specialists who are licensed under their college to deliver the same kind of exercise therapy to people with chronic comorbid conditions. But ultimately, you do need to have your care managed and coordinated by your primary care physician. So they'll be able to refer you to the appropriate professionals in order to seek the results that you're after.
Dr. Angelo Sabag of Western Sydney University, thank you so much for joining us today.
No problem. Thank you, Gina, for having me.
Up next, Mayo Clinic Q&A takes a look at therapies to minimize side effects from breast cancer treatments. MedClinic Radio continues in just a moment.
With your Mayo Clinic Radio Health Minute, I'm Joel Streed. By the year 2030, researchers are predicting that close to half of U.S. adults will have obesity. Dr. Donald Hensrud says that projection is concerning because obesity is related to a number of health conditions such as diabetes, high blood pressure, and coronary artery disease.
From a health standpoint, it will contribute to decreased health status in the United States.
To reverse this trend, it's important to understand what causes obesity. While there are many factors, Dr. Hensrud says one big thing is that
we've engineered physical activity out of our lives. A simple example I use, we don't have to walk into the gas station to pay for our gas anymore. We just swipe at the pump. And if we do things like that hundreds of times during the day, all of that corresponds with decreased activity and increased weight.
He says that a more processed, higher calorie food supply is another big factor. For more information, talk with your healthcare provider or visit mayoclinic.org.
You're listening to MedClinic Radio, exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you. Once again, here's Gina Tedesco.
Treatments for breast cancer are changing, becoming more effective and tolerable. With this week's Mayo Clinic Q&A, here's Dr. Helena Gazelka.
Treatment for breast cancer can vary widely depending on the kind of the cancer and how far it has spread. Treatment options can include a combination of surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation therapy. Radiation therapy is often used after surgery to reduce the risk that the cancer will come back, but it isn't without side effects. Research is underway at Mayo Clinic to look at minimizing the side effects and inconveniences associated with radiation therapy for breast cancer. Well, joining us to discuss this today is Mayo Clinic radiation oncologist and breast cancer specialist, Dr. Robert Mutter. Welcome, Rob.
Thank you, Helena.
Thanks so much for being here today. I always look forward to learning something new, and I think this is a confusing topic, how much, what kind, et cetera. So I'm looking forward to learning from you today.
Well, I'm looking forward to being here.
Rob, do all patients with breast cancer receive radiation therapy, and how do you decide?
The best way, I think, to divide it is to think about patients that either have breast preservation or a lumpectomy and patients that have a mastectomy. And so one of the real breakthroughs in medicine came in, 50, 60 years ago when there were randomized trials that compared breast-conserving therapy, meaning lumpectomy versus mastectomy. And these trials showed equivalent outcomes between those two modalities, meaning a woman could preserve her breast and have the same long-term survival as doing a more aggressive mastectomy procedure. And so that lumpectomy procedure was combined with radiation to achieve those same results as mastectomy. So most patients that have a lumpectomy need radiation therapy. We do also give radiation therapy in some patients after a mastectomy as well. These are patients that have higher risk features, such as having node-positive disease, because we know that even after a mastectomy, that does not eliminate the risk of recurrence. And so certain patients may benefit from this combination therapy approach of radiation and surgery.
Rob, I feel like it's very confusing how many days of radiation are selected for an individual. I've heard people receiving 6 weeks, so 30 radiation treatments. Now I have a friend who is going through radiation and she told me she's having 19 treatments of all things.
Yes, this has been an area of lots of work in our field. It used to be that everyone received 5-6 weeks of radiation therapy. And for many years, we had the understanding that giving a little bit of radiation each day and spreading that treatment out over multiple weeks was the gentlest on the normal tissues, that that would lead to the least side effects. But over the last decade or two, there's been a lot of research which has kind of flipped that on its head and suggested that in breast cancer, we might actually be better off giving bigger doses each day and finishing in a shorter period of time, that that actually might be better at destroying the cancer cells, but limiting side effects to the normal tissues. So you see many different trials have happened over the last several years looking at these shorter regimens.
And how much more convenient for the patient too, not to have to go so many days.
And that's absolutely the truth. You know, historically, many patients might elect to do a mastectomy just because they couldn't afford to be away from their work, or imagine being out in a farm and during the middle of a farming season and having to give up 5 or 6 weeks of treatment. So these innovations have been really, really exciting. Just to give you an example, I mentioned for whole breast radiation therapy, the standard used to be 5 to 6 weeks of daily treatment. Well, we had a trial that came out last spring, which suggested that 5 days is just as good in terms of keeping the cancer away, and also was just as safe in terms of normal tissue effects. So that's a real benefit for patients.
That is quite a difference. Rob, what is the difference between standard radiation therapy and this proton beam therapy? And how do you decide if a woman is eligible for one versus the other?
X-rays or photons are what we've used to treat patients with radiation historically for decades and decades, ever since they were discovered. An X-ray is basically the same thing as when you go to get a chest X-ray, for example. These are the same particles or waves of energy, if you will, is used there. But with therapeutic radiation, like we use for radiotherapy, these are higher energy beams, and these enable them to penetrate tissue and head into the tumor. The thing about X-rays is they slowly attenuate through tissue, so we don't have the ability to really fully shape them as much as we might like. Whereas this newer technology called proton therapy is different in that regard. Protons have this ability to stop on a dime, and that's because they're charged and they have a mass, and so we can actually give them just enough energy to travel to the tissue and have them stop. And so all that tissue behind the tumor or the target is spared of radiation exposure. And of course, the name of the game and what I do in radiation oncology is put the radiation where it's going to help patients, avoid where it's the normal tissues where the patients aren't obviously benefiting and which could potentially lead to more side effects. So we're very excited about proton therapy as a technology to help patients. I will add one caveat about that, is that to accelerate a proton is charged, has a mass, and that enables it to stop on a dime. But to be able to actually accelerate them fast enough to be able to treat cancer patients, that requires some heavy duty equipment. It's not the type of thing that you're going to see, you know, across the corner from 7-Eleven. These are, you know, heavy duty equipment, and there's only a handful of centers in North America that have this equipment. So it comes with a bigger investment in terms of capital equipment for hospitals to consider, but we're very excited to be able to study proton therapy and to be able to offer proton therapy for patients that we think may benefit, including in breast cancer.
Rob, are there any known recurrence advantages as far as decreased recurrence or survivorship advantages using proton beam versus standard radiation therapy, or is it just the ability to target the beam better?
So in children, for example, we don't even have clinical trials ongoing. We've just accepted that children are more sensitive to radiation. We really want to limit any normal tissue exposure that we can, that that's of real importance. Where there's a lot of investigation now, both in the United States as well as internationally, is asking, well, what about in these other more common malignancies like breast cancer, where we know that the extra exposure to the normal tissues isn't helping patients? Can we use proton therapy in those situations to also reduce the risk of long-term complications? The challenge is to prove that you're actually, you know, reducing long-term complications, you have to be able to follow patients, treat hundreds and hundreds of patients, follow them decades until they're, you know, in their 60s, 70s and 80s and 90s, when they may actually develop, for example, heart disease and die of a heart attack. And so for us to prove that there's a difference between protons and x-rays will require a lot of investment into clinical trials, you know, participation of patients, and being really thoughtful about how those trials are designed, because, you know, even small differences, obviously, in terms of heart disease risk reduction are potentially clinically significant. But again, proving that in the context of a randomized trial may be challenging.
Up next, we continue our Mayo Clinic Q&A look at the increased use of proton therapy for breast cancer treatment. That's when MedClinic Radio continues.
Welcome back to MedClinic Radio. Once again, here's Gina Tedesco.
We continue now with our Mayo Clinic Q&A segment as Dr. Robert Mutter, a Mayo Clinic radiation oncologist, discusses new approaches to breast cancer treatment to limit patient side effects from radiation. Once again, here's Mayo Clinic Q&A host, Dr. Helena Gazelka.
Rob, you've mentioned side effects a couple of times. What are the both the short-term and potential long-term side effects, or I guess adverse effects of radiation therapy?
The most common side effect that patients experience during treatment is irritation of the skin. I tell patients, I ask them, have they had a sunburn before? Most of them in Minnesota with their fair skin, they say, yes, I have. And I say, you know, that's the most similar experience as what I would describe what we call radiation dermatitis. The severity of that depends on our treatment. And so in some patients that we treat, we're actually targeting the skin because the skin could be penetrated by the cancer cells. And so in those situations, we're giving full dose to the skin, being very aggressive. And those patients may experience a very brisk sunburn-like reaction, may blister and may be sore. The worst part can be under the arm where the arm is rubbing, and that can be tender. And then—
Yes, you know, if you've ever had a sunburn there.
Yeah.
people can relate to that. It's a very uncomfortable place to have a sunburn.
That's right. And so having that, you know, once the radiation's over, a week or two later, that typically fades into almost like a suntan, and then slowly the skin returns towards normal. But that's a nuisance. And so we've actually have a lot of innovative approaches that we have been studying at Mayo to reduce those risks. I have a colleague, Dr. Kim Corbin, who's the principal investigator of a clinical trial investigating what's called a barrier film. It almost looks like saran wrap that goes over the chest, and it seems to protect the skin from abrasion from clothes and other things like that. And it seems to really have a noticeable effect in our initial trials in terms of reducing dermatitis or skin reactions. And so we're studying that in a larger clinical trial through the Alliance Oncology Group. The other side effects I just mentioned briefly that some patients might experience is mild fatigue during treatment, and the breast or chest might feel a little bit more swollen than typical. In the long term, radiation also has side effects, and that's where a lot of this research interest is in terms of trying to limit exposure of the normal tissues. By doing so, can we reduce the risk of these late side effects from radiation? So we already talked about the potential for accelerating the risk of heart disease. This is something that we pay extremely close attention to in designing our radiation therapy plans now. It used to be that doctors were perhaps paying less attention to this potential risk because the heart can actually tolerate a fair bit of radiation acutely. But it's really what was found out after many decades of following patients is that patients who have radiation exposure to the heart, even low doses, this can accelerate the process of atherosclerosis or hardening of the arteries. This is the disease that leads to heart attacks. And so we saw, in, for example, in patients that had left-sided treatment in the 60s and 70s, they had a little bit higher risk of heart disease than patients treated for the right side. So much of what we do now is designed to limit as much as possible any exposure to the heart.
What other kind of research is going on around this, Rob, that you're working on and your colleagues?
Proton therapy is a big interest because we could almost, in many instances, nearly completely eliminate that heart exposure. And so that's very exciting to be able to talk to patients, and we talk about that risk. And we say in the past, the risk of heart disease, let's say, may have been 1% or 2% based on a patient with your clinical characteristics by the time you're 80 years old. And we can say, well, with protons, we can reduce that dose down tenfold. And so we think that the risk is going to be just a fraction of that in the long term. And so that's really been exciting to be able to study proton therapy in that context. We also have other techniques that we have been investigating and using in the clinic, you know, routinely. We treat patients often in a full inspiration. And by expanding the lungs, that often pushes the heart down and away from where we want to be treating. In some patients, especially those with more ptotic breasts, it may be beneficial for them to be treated on their stomach. When they're on their stomach, the breast falls away from their chest, and that can often create the best beam angles. And so the great thing about working with Mayo is we have this amazing team of physicists and dosimetrists and therapists that help us execute these treatments, and we have all the tools. We can pick the best one for each patient, whether it be proton therapy or this prone technique or the breath hold. We have everything available so we can make the best decision for each patient.
That's interesting. Rob, we were talking earlier about how inconvenient it can be to have multiple radiation therapy treatments, albeit necessary at times. But how long does it take to administer traditional radiation or proton beam per episode when a woman comes in?
Our appointments are typically 30 to 45 minutes in length. A lot of that time is spent setting patients up. So the beam might only be on 5 or 10 minutes, but a lot of this time is setting the patient up exactly like they were when they came in for their first appointment, which was a planning session. So we do this planning session, which involves a scan. Then we use that scan to design a radiation plan, again, with our team, just tailored to that individual patient. And then when they come back for their treatment, we set them up the exact same way. Typically, it's with their arms kind of comfortably up, almost as though they had behind a pillow, just relaxing. And we take pictures of their anatomy, of their bones on the proton side. We even look at their surface anatomy to make sure it's perfectly aligned. And then finally, we turn the beam on after all of that effort. And sometimes it's a little anticlimactic. You don't feel anything for patient, you know, when you get treatment. It's just like getting a chest x-ray and then it's over. And often the side effects from radiation, if patients experience like the skin irritation, that's usually something that starts to happen several weeks into the treatment. And so the patient may go home and say, did I even get the treatment? And I have to assure them that yes, indeed, we did. We record that and we executed the treatment just perfectly. We took pictures and to show that that's the case.
Rob, how can patients know that they are getting the right treatment for their cancer?
I think it's something that, you know, it's difficult to quantify, but I think it's something that patients can experience when they talk with a physician, almost like engaging here with someone like you, where they feel comfortable, where they have all their questions answered, where they get a sense of the expertise of that individual that they're speaking to. In the case of Mayo, like I mentioned earlier, it's a real, you know, enormous team of experts to be able to operate these facilities like we have and offer every all the latest technologies. It requires a wonderful team to be able to execute these treatments safely, and so that's another part of it. How do you, you know, the comfort mm-hmm. that you feel in the environment where you're getting treatment. The other thing I would say is that, you know, at Mayo, we're often trying to not just offer the treatment that your mom or got or your grandma got back in the day. You know, we're really trying to advance the field and do better for our patients. And so an example of that, over the last several years, we've been offering patients a type of radiation called partial breast radiation, mm-hmm. where we just treat the area around the lumpectomy cavity where the tumor was originally. And we developed a regimen here at Mayo where we're giving the radiation in just 3 days. And so again, wow. We kind of returning back to, you know, when I was in training, some of these patients were getting 5-6 weeks of daily treatment not that long ago. And now we're offering patients, you know, this opportunity for being done in just 3 days and heading back to their their families and opportunities like that. And so those are other things that I think really differentiate a place like Mayo Clinic, where we're really at that cutting edge and trying to constantly do better for our patients.
Rob, in so many areas during the pandemic, we've started using virtual visits. Does radiation oncology use any virtual visits to reach patients for consultations?
We do. We do virtual visits routinely. I would say this has really increased in our practice as well since the pandemic started. And that's been exciting. I remember consultations with patients recently from Tennessee, for example, or other parts of the country, and where they've had an opinion locally and they're requesting a second opinion. And, it may not have been feasible to get that second opinion in the past where, to travel up to Rochester for a 1 hour consultation. That may, that investment may or not have been worth it, but we can have this visit and we can discuss, yes, you'd be a candidate for this short course of treatment, or yes, proton therapy is a good option for you. And then we can arrange for the follow-up where they come up for a planning session for the radiation and the treatment, and they do it all in one trip. So the virtual visits have been really been wonderful to be able to connect with patients much more easily.
It is. It's a true silver lining of the COVID pandemic. There aren't too many, but that's one of them.
That's exactly right. It really is.
Well, Rob, thanks for being here today. Anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, I just wanted to mention one other area of research that we're heavily invested in. I mentioned we're really doing much better in terms of our treatment outcomes for many patients. In fact, we're really trying to de-escalate our therapies. In fact, I mentioned that 3-day course of treatment for patients with very favorable disease. On the flip side, there are patients with higher risk disease where we really still have unsatisfactory outcomes. And I've been, doing this long enough where I've had patients where I care for and have grown very connected to that present with more what we call therapeutically resistant disease, where they've had their chemotherapy and the disease hasn't responded well to the chemotherapy. They've had their surgery, and there's still a lot of cancer left. And we know that these patients still have a very high risk of relapse. And as I mentioned, I've seen some of these patients go on to relapse even after our aggressive chemotherapy, surgery, and radiation. And so much of my lab program is directed towards trying to develop new therapies for these patients that have more therapeutically resistant breast cancer. And we're really trying to develop optimal combination therapy approaches where we're using medicines in combination with radiation to improve the efficacy of the radiation and reduce the risk of relapse. We're also interested in using radiation to try to stimulate the immune system in combination with different drugs. It turns out that the radiation can actually promote a better immune response directed at the cancer. And so we're really studying in the lab ways of enhancing that response to better fight off the cancer. So such that hopefully what we do right now, we have clinical trials available offering patients these combination therapy approaches, which seem to be quite efficacious in the laboratory in patients with resistant disease, and such that hopefully in the years ahead, we'll cure more of these patients of their disease.
Well, here at Mayo Clinic, we have an advantage because I can just call you up and ask you something. But how do patients typically find out about clinical trials that are available?
It's a really great question. There are, if you go to the websites, the Mayo websites, that's one way is to look online on our Cancer Center website. The other way is is to simply request an appointment with us. As I mentioned, we do these virtual visits, and so we're very happy to talk with patients and engage, whether or not they'd be a candidate for example, that very short course of radiation, or if they have a more higher risk radiation type, for example, after a mastectomy and they need a more aggressive therapy, would they be a candidate for some of these trials where we're combining new drugs with radiation to try to improve treatment outcomes for patients? So we're always happy and here to answer questions.
Well, that's wonderful. Thanks for being here today, Rob.
Thanks, Helena. It's been fun.
Our thanks to Mayo Clinic radiation oncologist, Dr. Rob Mutter, for being here today to talk to us about breast radiation for breast cancer.
You can find Mayo Clinic Q&A wherever you get and subscribe to your favorite podcasts. To see a list of all Mayo Clinic podcasts, visit newsnetwork.mayoclinic.org. And that's it for this week's Med Clinic Radio, produced by Syndication Networks of Chicago.
Our executive producer is Randy Meyer, and I'm your host, Gina Tedesco. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next week with more MedClinic Radio. Syndication
Networks. It's like I blinked, and suddenly all my business shifted to e-commerce.
Now my business hours are whenever my customers need me.
My customers want everything now and faster than ever. It's a whole different world.
Your business is changing. The United States Postal Service is changing with it. We're bringing you fast, reliable shipping nationwide. And we're bringing it right when your customers need it. Let's discover new routes. Visit usps.com/new routes. The United States Postal Service. Priority, you.
Get in the zone, AutoZone.
Welcome to AutoZone. What are you working on today? Of course we can help you gear up for that next oil change. We've got a great deal for the job. Right now you can get 5 quarts of Castrol GTX conventional or high mileage motor oil and an STP oil filter for just $28.99. And you can get it all fast, your way. Just order online with our free same day store pickup or next day delivery. Getting your job done just got easier. Restrictions apply.
Get in the zone, AutoZone.
Get mom the perfect gift at Macy's Mother's Day sale with an extra 25% off her favorite designers with your coupon or Macy's card. That's on top of already great deals like 35 to 55% off fine jewelry she'll love and 20 to 30% off handbags, accessories, and more great gift ideas. Plus, get your gifts even faster with same day delivery powered by DoorDash now at Macy's.com. Savings off regular sale and clearance prices. Exclusions apply.
Asthma symptoms can attack anywhere, like on a city street. Now you can get fast relief anywhere with new improved Primatene Mist, the only FDA-approved asthma inhaler available over-the-counter. So whether you need relief of symptoms at the park or at your kitchen table, Primatene Mist starts working quickly, opening up your airways to restore free breathing. For temporary relief of mild symptoms of intermittent asthma, use Primatene Mist and breathe easy again. Available at CVS, Rite Aid, and Walgreens. Use as directed.